Next month, I'm running a 5-week coaching program that will teach you how to write a killer CV, how to navigate the world of recruitment, and how to build your profile on and use LinkedIn with a very specific purpose. I'm also delighted to be hosting a 90-minute interactive masterclass with Caroline Goyder on the secrets of speaking with confidence. For more information on all of our programs, email me jane@careeringintomotherhood.com. You're listening to the Careering into Motherhood podcast with me, Jane Johnson, and today is the second of a two-part series on women in engineering. After talking to the absolute inspiration that is Ronnie Savage last time, my guests today are no less awe-inspiring. In a moment, I'm going to be talking to Roma Agrawal, whom I first saw when she was a guest judge on Channel 4's Lego Masters programme. Definitely a lockdown favourite in our house when the TV comes on. Roma grew up in India and studied at Oxford University and Imperial College. She's the author of the book Built, The Hidden Stories Behind Our Structures. She's director at ACOM Engineering, and she sits on the Mayor of London's Infrastructure Advisory Panel and does all this while campaigning hard for greater diversity in STEM fields. Thank you very much indeed for making the time. Construction has been one of those industries which was closed, then open, and now I'm not sure where we are with it. So are you working from home?
I had my little baby girl in July last year and had decided to take about 8 to 9 months off for maternity leave. And my first day back at work was due to be the 1st of April, which obviously then ended up right in the middle of lockdown. And the funny thing is that being the person I am, you know, really, I love what I do. I enjoy my work. I found maternity leave a real shock to the system.
Did you?
So yeah, real shock to the system. I didn't know what I was doing with myself. I felt like I was doing nothing but was completely and utterly exhausted all the time. So what I did was actually do a little bit of writing because, you know, I wrote a book, Built, which came out 2 years ago. And I had sworn to myself when I was writing my first book that I would never write another book again. As it happens, I've got a children's book coming out next year on construction. And what I had decided actually that I was going to take some time out from my construction career to do a bit more writing, because I felt that there was a bit more that I wanted to get out there. And so I'm actually currently on sabbatical from my construction job. And all of this kind of transpired just before lockdown. And you know, I guess in some ways it worked out really well for me.
So this idea, so you are obviously a hugely successful female engineer. You have a daughter. And I gather the survey that I read said that 11% of it, of the engineering workforce, is female. So massively reduced. And I have a young, I have a 5-year-old son. And the first thing, as soon as he could talk, he was interested in construction vehicles and tractors and all the books that he was given were really, I guess they were very male, if that, that sounds funny, but it, you know, for a child. But how did you get into engineering and construction, and is there any change, and where does that change need to start?
Yeah, the change needs to happen, but your statistics were right. So it's about 11 to 12% of engineers in the UK are women. That is the lowest statistic in the whole of Europe.
Yes.
So, you know, in Eastern Europe, there are countries which have coming up between 30 and 40% of engineers are women. So how did I get into it? I always liked maths and science. I didn't really know what career I wanted. I studied in India. And this is where I think I have an interesting perspective on the different cultures, perhaps, where in India, you know, parents aspire for their kids to do STEM careers. They want them to become doctors, accountants, engineers. You know, in some ways, it's quite boring that I've become an engineer, you know, oh, another Indian engineer, you know. I guess it was kind of part of our upbringing. My parents played construction toys and blocks with us throughout our childhood. We were always very exposed to science subjects. And so it didn't feel unnatural to me at all that I wanted to study, you know, science at university. And I didn't study engineering at university because I didn't really know what it was and what careers in engineering looked like on a day-to-day basis. So I studied physics. So while I was studying my physics degree and trying to consider what career I actually wanted to do, that's when I got exposed to engineering and decided that this is what I like. I want to use maths and physics to solve real world problems, to make real things. And I did a 1 year master's in structural engineering and then, you know, entered the world of construction from there.
Okay. And the survey that I read, the findings that said that women who go into it are 84% of them are either happy or extremely happy with their career choice. So you obviously find it, you must find it hugely fulfilling. And you've gone on, as you said, to write books and have a hugely successful career. How have you done that, being not a lone voice, but being 11% of the voice?
So I have enjoyed my career. I spent my first, I would say, 6 to 7 years, you know, head down, doing my job, you know, modeling buildings, doing calculations, going for meetings, solving problems, all of that kind of thing. And I think this is where being a woman really started to affect my career, which was that, you know, I worked on the Shard. I spent 6 years of my career working on the Shard. It's an iconic building and people were really fascinated by it. And me and my colleagues started getting invites to speak about our work at various different forums. But what I found was that because I was one of the few or only women structural engineers on the project, and also as a woman of color, I was getting invited to speak at completely different places. So not just to audiences of engineers, but also to school children and to women's leadership groups and, you know, to science festivals. And I think what I did was to find a way to communicate engineering that was accessible, that was lively, that was entertaining, that was exciting and interesting. Maybe perhaps engineers are quite well known for speaking quite seriously and with lots of jargon, and it doesn't feel very fun and accessible to everyone. So I think that that was where I was able to kind of make myself stand out. And those communication skills, yes, they were amazing for me. To, you know, I've written a book, as I said, and I've done a bit of podcasting myself, and I go and do loads and loads of lectures and talks and events. But it also helped me in my job because it meant that I could communicate quite complicated technical principles to other people within the industry who weren't engineers. And yes, that really, really helped me as well. So, you know, I have found it an extremely rewarding career. And I think when we were talking a little bit about the statistics and the need for change, you know, absolutely, we need to get more women, more people of color, more people from all the underrepresented minorities into our profession. What my job is and what we do as structural engineers, as architects, is we design homes, we design neighborhoods, we cities, you know, the homes and the bridges and everything that are being used by people. And I do really believe that if we don't accurately reflect the society that we're designing for, then we can't possibly design well. We can't come up with the best solutions for society.
Yes, certainly. So what can be done? What is it? Okay, let's start from the basics. What is it that in your experience that is a barrier to more women? Or are there barriers? Or is it simply, and the idea of engineering only appeals to 11%? Or do you see people dropping out and women dropping out and dropping away from the profession?
So let's start with your latter point. So yes, women and people from minority backgrounds disproportionately leave the engineering profession. They disproportionately will study engineering at university, but not pursue engineering as a career. And also, they are often disproportionately underrepresented on engineering courses. So there are a lot of issues there. There are statistics, which I wouldn't know off the top of my head, that say that people of color, people with so-called foreign-sounding names on their CVs, find it harder to get jobs. They get fewer interviews. So there's a lot of issues in that region that need to be addressed. Based on everything that's going on in the world right now, with Black Lives Matter and this push to, you know, try and really dismantle the institutional racism that we're seeing, I really believe that there's only so much that people like me can do. And it's the people in the majority and those that hold the power that need to step up and lead that change. So I'm calling on the leaders of our industry and people to say, look, I'm exhausted. you know, what change are you going to bring? What are you going to commit to try and correct this? Do you care about it? And if you do, what are you going to do about it? So I guess that's the conversation at one end of the scale. On the opposite end of the scale, I have a digger trouser and little onesie vest that my daughter wears. And I had to buy that from the boys' section. Because
really?
The girls' section has butterflies and fairies.
Unicorns.
And I find that deeply frustrating. So when we talk about the cultural barriers that women face, you know, it's staring at me from the day my daughter was born. The fact that everyone bought me pink stuff. The fact that pink stuff inevitably is about princesses and fairies and butterflies. And there's nothing wrong with any of those things. But I don't understand why we have this divide and make this assumption that is clearly not biological, that girls like particular things and boys like particular things. These very subtle and very unsubtle messages are being sent to children from the day they are born. So it isn't surprising to me that fewer girls study science and decide to pursue engineering.
Mm. I mean, you in your career, you very self-effacingly just sort of said, oh, yes, it was nothing unusual in my family or my culture where I grew up to go into engineering. But you must, to have reached the levels you have and internationally as well, you must have some very strong qualities that have got you to where you have, where you are. What do you think those qualities are? If one of our audience is listening now and her daughter is interested in going into engineering or architecture, what advice would you offer?
So I think I would say to young girls that you have a very valuable voice and a very valuable contribution to make. And I would also try and highlight the parts of engineering that typically get overlooked. One is that it's very creative because we're trying to solve problems in new ways all the time, do things that have never been done before. That's so incredibly exciting. And also that it's really rewarding. People tend to say that those of us from minority backgrounds are a bit more passionate about trying to change things or to have something that helps people as part of our careers. Younger people today are starting to say that they want that rewarding nature in their careers. And engineering can really provide that. So, you know, there's all these examples of how cholera epidemics in 19th century London, you know, in a huge part was stopped because of engineering, not because of medicine. So, you know, people forget that engineering has this really fundamental role to play in the wonderful lives that we lead, particularly in developing countries and also in the developed countries. And it's just, yeah, it's a really amazing profession to be a part of.
Yeah, fascinating. I never thought about that. And I guess, are you already seeing things like, you know, obviously the high-rise buildings that you are involved with, like the Shard, from what I'm hearing from friends who work in the city, those are going to be some of the last to go back because, you know, densely populated high-rise buildings. Someone was telling me that some of the ones over in Canary Wharf, they can't get back because just the physical distancing that's needed in the lifts to go 40 floors. So are you already, do you see on the horizon COVID-19 is going to impact engineering and design and that kind of thing?
It's definitely going to impact the way we design things. What exactly that impact is going to be, I think, is still under discussion. I think it's a really important discussion to have. And I am part of some panels and things that we're trying to look at that, you know, the longer term resilience of what we're designing. Part of that is transport systems, because you think about the London Tube, you know, that doesn't work for social distancing either. And we're thinking about public spaces as well, is, you know, how do you create spaces and people can safely go out and get some fresh air, but also your home, you know, there's all these flats where you can't open your windows or the amount you can open your windows is limited. And I think when we've designed things to date, we've not really envisioned a world where we would have to stay home for 3 or 4 months. Yeah. No. So, you know, absolutely things will change. And again, that just proves the need for the diversity in our profession and thought. You know, people that have lived in different types of homes during this process will have different input into those discussions. So it's, yeah, that's really important.
You touched upon that you went through IVF treatment while you were at work. So as I say, from what very little I know about the engineering profession, I would imagine being a pregnant woman, let alone also having to go through IVF. How did that affect your career? And, you know, how were your employers? How did you deal with that side of things?
So engineering has got a lot of kind of people and companies that don't get it, as it were. But there are a lot of companies and people that do get it as well. And, you know, I'm really lucky, but also it's my active choice to work for places that are supportive. And you can tell what the culture of a company is when you go for your interviews and so on, talk to other employees. And I think that's really important to consider. Because when I had to go through what I went through, I did have a big thought process where I wondered whether I should tell my employer or not that I was going to embark on fertility treatment. And I remember standing outside that meeting room where my boss was sitting, thinking, am I about to torpedo my career as I was about to go in to tell him? But I, you know, as a person, I'm generally not very good at hiding things for my, you know, about myself. You know, you can tell what my mood is just by looking at my face. You know, I'm not very good at hiding things. And I just couldn't see how I'd be able to go through such a huge life-changing experience. I didn't know whether it would work for me or not, because, you know, it's really important to acknowledge it doesn't work for everyone. I didn't know how many cycles I would need to have. I didn't know how many years this would take. And I just felt that if I couldn't have that support of my employer, I didn't really know how I was going to get through it. So I made the decision to tell them, and I'm really glad that I did, because I had their support. They already had a lot of flexible working arrangements in place, and that really helped. It transpired that I had 3 cycles in the end. I got very ill from my first one and needed to take time off sick. And when I then did get pregnant, I also told them I was pregnant very early on, which people usually don't do, because I said to him, if I have a miscarriage, I'm going to need to take some time off, and I just want you to know what's happening. And through all of this, and I should say that they're all male bosses that I spoke to throughout this process, I got an incredible amount of support.
Oh, that's really reassuring to hear. Did you go back to the same employer when you returned to work?
Well, so I am still technically employed by my same employer, but on sabbatical. So, I mean, I guess that's an interesting thing to touch on is, you know, being on maternity leave and thinking about this idea of writing and taking some time away to focus on a bit of writing. So one thing was clear to me is that I was working in my day job for 4 days a week while writing my first book. And that was incredibly busy and incredibly stressful. So I was clear that if I was going to do some more writing in the future, and if I had a child, then that just wasn't possible. I also thought about the fact that I've already taken 8 or 9 months out of my career. So, you know, to add on a few more months to do my own projects didn't feel like a big leap. So it felt like quite a comfortable transition. But I thought to myself, if I go back into the construction industry and then have to leave again because I wanted to do some writing or some podcasting or whatever it might be for myself later, that would probably be more challenging. So I decided just to kind of roll one against the other. And I think the other important thing to say, and, you know, I listened to the last episode of your podcast where you spoke to the women about postnatal depression, is that I developed postnatal depression myself about 4 months after my daughter was born. And I think because I was functioning, I was showering every day, changing my clothes, going out for coffee mornings, out in the park, doing all the stuff. Different health professionals just didn't believe me when I told them I thought I had postnatal depression. And so it took me 6 months to actually get the support. And I know you spoke to one of the trustees from Cocoon. It was really through Cocoon that I finally got the right kind of support. And so with all of that playing on my mind as well, it just felt like the right time to take some time for myself, work at my own pace, ensure that I'm looking after my mental health properly. But at the same time, because work is so incredibly important to me, I had to find a way to work. I decided that, okay, I think this is a really good time to do that scary thing that I've been thinking about for years, which is to take a year off and just do some media projects for myself.
My next guest is Dr. Enjamina Faustin, who came over from the West Indies, where she had studied her first degree in civil engineering, and then she did a master's at Imperial College London before going on to do her PhD at Cambridge University. Today, she's a senior geotechnical engineer at the engineering firm AECOM, although, as she mentions, she's currently on furlough, which she took after trying to work the most crazy hours and with her two young children at home. Engimelia and I talk about changing the stereotypes in engineering.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for having me here today. I actually grew up in Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean, and there are very little options or career guidance for young people. And I was very much interested in sciences and math. And the natural progression for me would have been to study math and physics at university, which is what I applied to study. But I took a gap year, and by coincidence, I worked for a construction company who were building a stadium for the FIFA Under-17 World Cup, which was happening around that time. And that was quite enlightening to me, and I met engineers, and it opened my eyes up to this world of engineering that I hadn't heard of before or knew anything about. So when I started university a few months later, I switched my degree course within the first week.
And was that in the West Indies?
That was at the University of the West Indies, yeah. So I switched to civil engineering. It was the only engineering discipline that I could get a spot on.
And were you the only woman on the course?
No, there were a few of us. We started off as a class of 60, but at the end of the period, only 12 of us graduated. I don't remember how many females, but less than five.
Really? And why do you think that was? I mean, obviously, it's for someone like me, I'm an arts graduate, so engineering is extremely difficult to get my head around. But why did so many people drop off the course?
It's very demanding. There are lots of barriers. You know, being an engineer, we were expected to go to site to see or make decisions about how things are constructed. And as a young engineer studying at university, we did quite a few site visits, and there weren't any role models, I would say. I didn't see any. I remember one other female being on one of the construction sites I visited, and I was quite in awe of, you know, how she was able to have this control of, you know, this large male workforce. So I think that could be a huge barrier if you're not confident, if you're just finding yourself as you are at university, you could be quite daunted.
Yes, yeah, certainly. So would you say you were always quite a confident person, or have you learnt these skills and, you know, the ability to hold your own in these circumstances?
I think some of it, a lot of it is down to my parents, the type of childhood that I had, and developing confidence in a young age and encouraging us to try anything. But I think when I started to work as an engineer, I had to, you know, quickly come up to speed and learn to be confident, learn to speak up, just to be able to do my job. You know, being an engineer is one of great responsibility. And there's a lot of collaboration with other teams, other disciplines. And you do need to have a voice and be, you know, speak up, be confident. So I've learned some of it along the way.
And so you did your first degree in the University of the West Indies, and then where did you go from there? Did you go into a job in the West Indies?
No, I came to England. So basically, in civil engineering, there are a range of different fields. So there's transportation, building highways or tunnels, there's buildings, water resources. And I was particularly inspired by geotechnical engineering, which is an area of civil engineering that deals with everything below the ground, so the soil and the rock. And this was quite interesting to me because for me, it was just dirt, it was soil. But it played such an important role in making sure that the structures we need as society are safe and stable. And Imperial College in London was one of the top universities to get greater knowledge or understanding of geotechnical engineering. So I came to the UK immediately after completing my undergraduate degree in Trinidad with the intention of going to Imperial College. So when I came to the UK, I applied for an engineering job to get some experience. And within the first week of applying, I had three job offers.
Oh, really?
I was very fortunate at that time. And I worked for 2 years before I did the degree at Imperial College, the master's degree.
And when you came to London, how did that feel? You'd obviously left your family and everyone behind. You were embarking on, you know, work and with a vision to to go on and do further study. Again, I just sort of keep coming back to this. You must have a real sense of determination and drive. And yet you're obviously in a minority, not only being female, but not seeing people around you that look the same.
You are right, Jane. And I think that was one of the benefits, even though I probably didn't appreciate it at the time, of growing up in Trinidad, where I was not the minority. So when I came here to the UK, I didn't have much issues with my confidence because of my ethnicity or my gender as such. But when I came to the UK, I was very surprised. I found it was a lot more open. So I haven't really experienced, I never felt that prejudice because of my racial background. But being a woman, it was very apparent that I was different, or I noticed, but I did feel quite different. For example, when I had my first visit on a site, so it was for Crossrail. Crossrail is a new railway which is being built in England. So I was a young engineer on site, and I was responsible for overseeing the work that the ground investigation contractor was doing to identify the risks that may be present in the ground. And when I walked into the site office, there was a page 3 model poster on the wall, and I was shocked. So I mentioned it to the site foreman, and he said, well, you can put your own up if you want. And I wasn't quite too sure how to take that. So that was one instance where it was quite, you know, openly prejudice, I would say, to me as being a female. And the other thing that stands out to me is not having any female welfare facilities. So I had to share the same bathroom as my male counterparts. And that felt quite hard.
And is that changing? Has that changed?
Definitely. I think the industry as a whole are very much aware of the needs of women, and there are a lot of facilities. We've come a long way. There are a lot of, if I go to a construction site now, there are a lot of improvements, a lot of measures. Women are well accounted for. So the industry has made great progress in that area. And that comes from awareness. And I think having open discussions of these issues.
Yeah. And then I'm right in saying that you've also gone into or onto further education, and you've done a lot of work at Cambridge University, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I've done a PhD in ground engineering at the University of Cambridge. I actually finished three years ago. As a female, I feel some sort of responsibility, and being in an ethnic minority group, I do feel some sort of responsibility to really be role model and to really push myself to achieve.
That's really interesting, that sense of responsibility. I guess, how does that manifest itself? Do you think it drives you further, or do you feel you have to talk more about what you're doing? How does it manifest?
I think it does drive me. It's not something that I have at the forefront of my mind in everything that I do, but it is lurking in my mind that I need to really be able to inspire confidence in others, not only females, but also, you know, people of different ethnic minorities. And I feel that when I look at my background and how I entered engineering and where I live today and why maybe I have a bit more confidence than someone who grew up in the UK all their life, I think it's because I had role models around me in Trinidad who I saw who were successful. And I think today with social media, I really try to have an online presence highlighting the work I do, my achievements, so that any younger persons looking at my profile or stumbling across my profile can really be inspired to achieve their best as well and know that it's possible.
Yes, definitely.
I think that's really important to have these allies.
Yes. So, Njamila, you've talked about your own journey and how you got into engineering, but clearly there are very few people from different ethnic backgrounds and few women in STEM and particularly engineering subjects. So what can we do? What more can be done to open up fields like engineering to more diverse people?
I think that there are a number of ways that we can create more diversity within not only engineering, but other fields that are traditionally closed. first and foremost, I think we need to start with the young people. As a parent, I can see with my kids that they are, I would say, natural engineers. They're constantly trying to understand how things behave and engage in the world around them. Only yesterday, my six-year-old tried to make a contraption to fit onto his bike to tow the younger child. And he started off with sellotape, and he realized that didn't work. So he then used string, and that didn't work. And he went through this process for a good few hours and then eventually used a rope. And I could just see the excitement or happiness when he got it to work and they were able to, well, he was able to cycle off towing his brother. So I think we really need to engage with the children at all levels to just encourage that experimentation. And then as a profession, we could, and we are doing this to some extent, creating links between schools and other engineers and engaging with or having programs specifically related around STEM subjects and pathways. But not only with children, we could also look at the parents, because one review, the Perkins review, which I read recently, highlighted that parents are play a very crucial role in encouraging an interest in engineering.
Do they?
So if we work with the parents, yes.
What sort of things? Because I'm personally interested. My son is absolutely obsessed with Lego, and he does exactly like you say as well. You know, he's always trying to put things together and build things. And I don't know, maybe I suppose I perhaps sometimes say, well, you know, just leave me alone, I'm just doing some work or something. So I'd love to know what more we could do to foster that interest.
Have you ever built it with him?
Yes, yes, we do lots of Lego building as a family. That's an insight into my weekend.
No, I think that's really good. I mean, building Lego is where it all starts, you know, learning how things can be built stable, designing objects. I mean, designing, you know, different Lego creations, that's a major part of engineering, is being creative. I know we don't, As a career, we often think it's all about the technical skills, you know, the math and the physics and the sciences, but there's a huge creative aspect of being able to come up with an idea and, you know, see it through to completion. And I think Lego definitely helps with that. But I think other things that you can do is just allow them to experiment. I find children are their own, you know, they sort of know what activities they need to be doing. So instead of saying, oh no, don't do that water play, you will wet up the floor, you know, just put things in place so that they could explore freely and then you tidy up afterwards. But just not, I think, sort of stunting that imaginative play or creativity will go a long way.
Yes. And what about this idea of girls going into the field of engineering? Have you done much study or looking at that side of things, and or just your thoughts on why it is? Because I'm just thinking now, which is something I haven't really thought about before, why when we think of, you know, children's toys, it does seem to be that mostly boys will play with Lego and girls will sit down and do crafts.
Art and craft, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the statistics are clear. There are much less females doing, you know, science subjects or math subjects later on at GCSEs or A-levels. But I think that's, you know, comes back to my point that parenting is crucial for encouraging this interest in engineering. And if we could really work with the parents not to inadvertently have this subconscious gender bias with their toys or the environment in which they set up for their kids to play and learn, then we could make huge headways. I mean, once my son came home from school and said, "Mum, girls don't like trains." And I said,
"Oh, really?
I like trains. I build trains." But I designed tunnels for trains. And he was quite surprised. But I think, you know, just that simple statement, you know, that little explanation, he won't make that statement again.
Oh, that's brilliant. So what's next? My goodness, you've risen right up to the top, and you know, you've got the PhD, and I know you've got a family as well. What do you see next on your horizon? Is it time to take the foot off the gas at all yet?
Well, to be honest, it's funny that you should use that expression, because I had my first son at the end of my first year. I have two kids, two boys, and I had my first son at the end of my first year of my PhD. And I thought, well, that's it. My career is over. I really did. I think I cried for days thinking, you know, how do I tell everyone that it's over? But my PhD supervisor was hugely supportive. And I discovered that motherhood or becoming a parent, not necessarily motherhood, but even fathers, doesn't mean that it's the end of your career. There is a shift, but this is just life's natural journey, and you learn to manage your career and have your kids at the same time. And it is certainly possible.
So how do you do that now? Is your employer quite flexible? How do you sort of juggle the childcare with work and study?
I think flexibility in the workplace. So I work for a company called Aecon, which is a large global infrastructure company. And flexibility in the workplace was a big attraction for me in joining that company.
And can I ask, was it offered when you joined, or did you have to negotiate your flex?
It was offered. When I went for the interview, I was heavily pregnant with my second child. And the interview went by quite smoothly. I would say I enjoyed it. And at the end of the interview, there were no references made to me having a baby soon. So I mentioned, when I was asked if there were any questions that I had for them, if there were, you know, I was going to have a baby soon. And if, hypothetically speaking, if I were to be offered a position, when would they like me to start? And they, you know, they said, yes, we noticed, very calmly. And they said it was up to you. So I was quite shocked. So I said, oh, I plan to take 1 year maternity leave. And they said, well, it's up to you. Our company policy requires that you take at least 6 months. So that was, I was blown away. And then once I started, I worked full time, but I start early. I start at 7 a.m. and I finish at 3 p.m. And that allows me to be able to do the school run, have dinner with my kids every evening. And I think the company's policy, and most companies are moving towards this flexible working system, at least in engineering, is that if you can do your job, it doesn't really matter where you do it or how you do it, as long as you meet the requirements of the client and it works for your team. And I've found like honest and open communication with everyone I'm working with to let them know my working hours helps me not to feel guilty about leaving, you know, leaving the job a bit early.
Yeah, that's really interesting that someone even at your level still talks about a feeling of guilt.
It's definitely there.
It's very common.
Yeah. I think having, you know, doing the PhD whilst being a parent made realize that it's not about the number of hours you spend at a desk. That's not necessarily a good measure of productivity.
Yes. And can I ask, obviously during lockdown, how have you managed? I guess you've got the boys at home, and are you working from home, you and your partner?
I have to admit it's been a struggle. We have been home since the 15th of February. And I am homeschooling one, and my youngest is 1.5. So it is quite a challenge. Typically, I work early morning, so I would start at 6 and I would stop at 9. And then I would resume later on in the evening once the kids have gone to bed. But as I mentioned, we have been doing this since February. So a couple of weeks ago, I actually accepted furlough. I realized this was just a bit too difficult to burn the candles at both ends.
And have you, what I was going to say, how has it sort of impacted your sense of well-being, and what do you do? Do you get any time to do anything to keep yourself on an even keel?
I think during this period of lockdown, before I went on furlough, I didn't have any time to think about me. You know, I would think about the kids and work and, you know, and then work again. But now that I don't have work per se in terms of the everyday responsibilities, the days are still busy with the demands of homeschooling and just caring for a younger child. But I have managed. This is the first week I'm doing an exercise challenge.
Oh, really?
Challenge, and I've just completed week one.
Well done.
But I must admit, I engaged a buddy, so I asked a friend to join me on this journey because it really helps if. Well, at least for me, I find it helps if I'm accountable to someone.
Yes, that's a great idea. That's a great idea. So you both set yourself the same challenge each week, or you actually work out together? How does it work?
I think we're doing slightly different challenges, but we text each other once we're about to start. And I know I'm doing this workout, and this other friend of mine who's also a parent is doing that workout as well, you know, just for 20 minutes. But knowing that you are not doing this alone helps. And I think we as mothers really need to have that support network.
Yes, that's very true. Definitely. Well, thank you so much, Njamila. It's been really interesting, fascinating talking to you. And you really are such an inspiration. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Jane.
I hope you've enjoyed our two-part mini-series on women in engineering. I've learned so much from these incredibly inspiring women who are all leading the way for others and for future generations. My thanks to Ronnie, Roma and Njamila. If you find the podcast helpful, please do leave your comments and a review or send me any feedback. I really do enjoy hearing from you and all your inspiring stories. Next month, I'm running a 5-week coaching program that will teach you how to write a killer CV, how to navigate the world of recruitment, and how to build your profile on and use LinkedIn with a very specific purpose. I'm also delighted to be hosting a 90-minute interactive masterclass with Caroline Goyder on the secrets of speaking with confidence. For more information on all of our programs, email me jane@careeringintomotherhood.com.